Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Sanchez caught Young and Fashanu in there. And Sanchez was in there, and that's a goal for Wimbledon. Laurie Sanchez. Well, what a typical Wimbledon goal. Dennis Wise delivers the free kick. Laurie Sanchez sneaks in and glances it into the far corner. Oh, the tension here. He's checked with both linesmen. Oh, and there it is. The crazy gang have beaten the Culture Club. Wimbledon have destroyed Liverpool's dreams of the double. And all over the pitch, their players are celebrating something which a few years ago would have been impossible. Sporting gesture by the Liverpool supporters. Her Royal Highness applauds one of the great cup shocks of all time.
Yeah, hard to believe it is 30 years ago this year that Wimbledon caused the greatest shock in FA Cup final history, beating Liverpool. What a line from John Motson on commentary. The crazy gang beating the Culture Club. And the man who made it all possible, who scored the winning goal that day, Laurie Sanchez, is on the line now. Evening, Laurie.
Good evening to you.
I'm sure you've heard that commentary and watched the goal back thousands of times at this stage. Is that a moment? Is that a goal? Is that a day that changed your life forever?
Does it change my life? As you look back on it, at the time when you were living it, you didn't realise how important it was. When you look back on it now, and you still talk about it 30 years later, you realise that perhaps it was it certainly was a defining moment in my playing career. No doubts about that, and probably the club's Wimbledon's playing time as well. And but it is a memory. Now, John Motson famously retired this week or at the end of this season as well, and he mentioned, that it was one of his highlights. So, it's good. I mean, it's nice for your son to be able to have those memories of his father, if you want.
You really get a sense, even from the audio commentary there, of the atmosphere on the day, the sheer volume of noise within the stadium, reflective of just how big an FA Cup final was back then. It was bigger than the European Cup. It was bigger than the league title. This was the one day of the year that football was centre stage in every single household in countries around the world.
Well, I mean, you've got to remember as well, it was the last all-standing game at Wembley. So it was a 92,000 crowd there, before it went down to all-seater and lost, 18,000 places. So it's a massive crowd. Again, it was the last time that the FA Cup was shown on both BBC and ITV. And, their build-up used to start in the morning, There used to be it's the knockouts and celebrity this, celebrity that, all around the cup final, leading up to the cup final being the peak. I mean, the whole day was set aside for the cup final. Not like it is at this moment in time where, it's pushed to 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or this or that, or other things take more precedence. It was the defining game of the season. And you've got to remember as well, Liverpool, who were exceptional at that time. I mean, John Barnes was player of the year, I think, and Peter Beards, who was in that team. If they had been in Europe, I mean, we had the five-year ban at that time. Mm. If they'd been in Europe, they'd have another couple of European Cups under their belt, I'm sure, that side. They're a magnificent side. They'd won the league at a romp. And we were up against them on what was a defining day for myself and for our club, and we stood up to the challenge. Luckily, I scored the goal, but it stands out there now, years later, as one of those real rags to riches story. A team that had come from non-league 25 years previously to have beaten the best team in probably Europe at the time.
Yeah, it's important to reinforce that point, probably for younger listeners, because this game is my earliest memory of watching football, and for anybody probably 35 or older, it's a game that's etched in their minds. It was such a brilliant story because Liverpool were such an outstanding team. It was only 5 or 6 weeks after they'd beaten Forest 5-0 in a league game that's often described as their best ever performance. They were a team, if they were in Europe, probably would have still been winning European Cups. Whereas now, if you were to look at it statistically, you would think, well, Wimbledon finished seventh in the league, they finished sixth the previous year, that this is like Burnley beating Manchester City in a cup final, which wouldn't be seen as one of the great underdog stories. But from playing Division 4 football 7 years earlier, it was the ultimate rags to riches story.
It was, and as I say, people don't realise. I mean, you know, in my time, you know, my generation, Liverpool were the Man City, Manchester United, Arsenal rolled into one of that time. You know, the 70s and mid-70s to early 80s, they were the dominant force in English football. And, you know, they were exceptional, and they were dominant in Europe as well. So for us to go there on that, you know, when they were going for the double and to turn over that team, and deserve to at the end of the day as well, I think we deserve to win the game. To do that, you know, made it doubly pleasurable, if you want. And I think we were 4-1 underdogs at the time. And it's unusual in a two-man final to have 4-1 underdogs, especially if we'd finished, I think we finished eighth in the league that year. So we weren't, you know, we weren't by any means a poor side. But we played a certain way, they played a certain way. So there's a clash of cultures as well, you know. And all those things came together to make what was not a memorable final playing-wise, but a memorable result, if you want.
I was wondering, all right, how now, 30 years on, you look back at the way we still talk about this game and the coverage as Wimbledon being this ultimate underdog, considering how well you were playing in the league, considering the talent of the players within that team. When you look at the players alongside you, Vinnie Jones, Dennis Wise, John Fashanu, Terry Gibson, Dave Besant in goal, John Scales coming off the bench, the fine careers so many of those players had. This wasn't a team that was still in the non-league. This was a team, as you say, had a very set style that was somewhat in stark contrast to the way Liverpool played. But it was a style that worked far more than just on this one day in Wembley.
Yeah, and you missed Terry Phelan out of there, obviously a Republic star. Yeah, we were, I think at the time, we weren't regarded, despite the fact of the rise of the story from, I mean, although they've been in the league 25 years, the rise from the Division 4 took, to the top division took 5 years, I think. And then we finished sixth our first season in the top division. I think we finished seventh or eighth in the second season. We played the cup game. And in fact, we were the last team, I think, to win at Anfield in the league prior to that. We'd won the previous season, and that was the last time Liverpool had been beaten at home in the league. So we, in ourselves, we were confident of our abilities and what we could do. But I think that it's the rise of the story of Wimbledon from where it had begun to where they were competing against the giants of Europe. And the fact that we won it. You know, if we'd have lost it, a lot of people wouldn't even refer to that cup final. It'd just be another one. But the fact that we actually won it and deserved to win it. And we played, as I say, there was a clash of styles. As well. Liverpool were the culture club, as John Watson famously said about them. And we were the crazy gang of South West London, you know. So it was a clash of stars as well as everything. Clash of cultures, clash of clubs, clash of history, you know, clash of new boys against old boys. It was a clash on many, many levels. And ultimately, a team that we were the underdogs, but probably to the ordinary person in the street, we were their team against you know, the aristocrats of Liverpool. And you know, it's nice when that story sometimes gets turned on its head.
One of the reasons as well that we still look back on it is because of, I don't want to say it's taken on a mythical status, but was the crazy gang, because I think there was nothing mythical about it. It seems everything that we heard happened did happen, from the burning clothes of new signings, to the drinking sessions, to the fighting inside the dressing room, and the recent documentary that came out gave a good insight into it. When you look back now, long since having left Wimbledon, just how crazy were those times?
It's strange. I say to people often ask me that question, what was it like being part of that culture or in that situation? And when it's your daily life, you just accept it for normal. It's like being in the middle of a hurricane or a tornado. When you're right at the eye of it, it seems completely normal to you. It's only when you come outside that you realise all the turmoil and destruction and everything that people see it from outside that it causes, you know. And we, you know, as I say, we led it. It was our daily lives. I mean, you had to be sharp as a pin in the dressing room, you know, banter-wise and all sorts-wise. On the training field, you had to be sharp as well, you know. You couldn't have a day where you thought, I'll just take this easy today. But, you know, the tackles flew in and everything in training. We trained like we played, to be fair. And when we crossed the line together, you know, we didn't all get on. I mean, you know, this is well-documented. We didn't all get on. But once we crossed the line, we were in it together. And we were a team. And a team, ultimately, is the sum of the parts is greater than the actual parts itself. And we were that. You know, we together, we gelled. in a way that perhaps as individuals, if we'd just done our own thing, we wouldn't have done. We had a method of successful. We believed in it. We were successful. And we took it, you know, along with good coaching, we took it to people and you know, showed them, well, we're here. Let's get on with it. And, you know, sometimes teams got carried away with the crazy boy stuff, wanted to prove how strong they, how tough they were, and they forgot that they were better footballers than us and wanted to concentrate on the physical aspect. And in those days, you could be more physical than you could now. I mean, you know, you see the tackles now that stopped you up. I mean, your eyes in our day, not just us, but the whole division at that time. You know, tackles were allowed to crunch in, people were allowed to challenge for balls with elbows. You know, all sorts used to go on. But obviously with 20-odd cameras nowadays, and most of that is not, you know, we were only covered by one or two cameras in our days, you know. So most of that stuff wasn't caught on film. But today, any indiscretion is caught on film and reviewed afterwards, something that never happened in our day. But
yeah.
That said, with all the other stuff, the other day, most of those players went on from that cup final. I mean, Dave Besson left that season after that summer to go to Newcastle, and he was a world record transfer for a goalkeeper. I mean, Terry Phelan went on and left and was a record signing, world record signing as a left back. Scales left later on and became a world record signing as a centre half. You know, so all these players went on and proved, and most of them capped internationally. I think the final gave us credibility, and after that, people realised, yeah, these are good players, and we need them in our team. They're winners, you know.
So with that in mind, do you look back at that time and think, yeah, we got the absolute maximum out of this group of players? Or is there also a part of you that looks and thinks, well, actually, maybe if we'd had a slightly different way of playing at times, a slightly different attitude within the group, we could have gone on and achieved even greater things?
No, we as I said, we were better than some of our parts. And the other thing is, would have been interesting for the Cup Winners' Cup, it would have been in those days, wouldn't it? And we would have got into Europe, having won the cup, and we would have played in Europe, and we would have rampaged through Europe as well. We have no doubts about that. The way we played, our level of commitment, what we could achieve at Plough Lane, or you know, as we played in those days before the Premier League, we could have rampaged through Europe. But I'd love to us to have a tour at a European competition, because I wouldn't have put it past us to win one.
Yeah, European football wouldn't have seen too many teams like Wimbledon, I dare say.
No.
For anyone who hasn't seen it, the Crazy Gang documentary that came out quite recently, it's well worth a watch. I was wondering if you noticed any sort of a change in attitude amongst people towards what Wimbledon achieved since that came out, and a lot of the stories, because I guess it was 30 years ago, our attitudes towards what masculinity is and what men are meant to be has changed a lot in terms, and in football has changed a lot in terms of violence, in the way players speak to each other now, and the just general attitudes around training grounds and what's acceptable. Do you look back in hindsight and think, wow, some of the things that we got up to and some of the pranks that they may have been seen back then, some of the attitudes towards new signing, towards younger players were unacceptable? Or do you feel it was 30 years ago, it was just the way things were at the time?
Yeah, they wouldn't have been acceptable today. I mean, no bones about that. There would have been accusations of bullying, and well-founded accusations of bullying. I think John Scales brought it up in the video himself. He didn't say the word, but he felt intimidated by some of the stuff that went on. Players didn't make it at our club. I mean, good players came in, and for one reason or another, they couldn't deal with the situation at the club, with everything that went around it. So, yeah, I make no bones, you know, that club as such couldn't survive in the modern day with the modern scrutiny, the modern era, the modern snowflake generation would not be possible to, you know, there'd be court cases left, right and centre. But it was 30 years ago, and the culture, whether people like it or not, culture 30 years ago was completely different to the culture now. You know, some would say today for the better, and I'd probably agree with that. You know, certainly some of the things we got up to or what happened in the dressing room, you're not accepting any dressing room today. But it was a different time, and much as you can talk about, well, it shouldn't have happened then, if it shouldn't happen today, different generations have different standards, you know. I think famously, I was just reading the paper today, they're going to show the Dam Busters film in 400 cinemas, and they're going to leave the original name of the dog in it, which you obviously can't say today because it's a completely non-acceptable term. But in the 1940s, nothing was thought of it. So, you know, there are different generations, and the producer of the film said, you have to accept what was acceptable at the time. you can't, in hindsight, look back on it and say, well, today it's not acceptable, therefore we have to rip down everything that went with it. You have to get on with it, you live in the area that you live in.
So when you meet up tomorrow night and there's a little bit of a reunion at AFC Wimbledon to honour the 30-year anniversary, do you all look each other in the eye and think, yeah, we soldier together, we achieve something great? Or is there maybe in the wake even of the documentary, is there a part of you that are looking at each other thinking, all right, we realise we overstepped the line here at times?
No, I think now I saw... I love American films about sport. And I can't remember the name of the film, and the talk before of the final with these players was that sometime in the future, when you're old men, you'll be able to look across the room and know you've achieved something together. Mm. You won't have to say anything. You can just look, and you know. And that's all we have, you know. Whether we like each other or not, whether we're best friends or not, however we get on today or however we got on then, you look across the room and you know that you shared something with people that was unique. And that is something, whatever way you look at it, is special.
And it still is special, even to this day, this FA Cup victory, because the way the FA Cup has been tainted over probably almost 25 years at this stage, even talking around the office, people asking, what time is the cup final on Saturday? Whereas, as you say, everyone knew it was 3 o'clock Saturday, the build-up began at 9 a.m. and we got such a good insight into the squads and the teams and the way the BBC and ITV covered it. When you look back then and the day and the week leading up to the cup final, are there memories that stand out of not just the game and winning, but really the hype around the event?
Yeah, I mean, on one respect, the hype today is 10 times more. I mean, much as you rightly say, people say, well, what day is it and when is it and what kickoff time? And you used to know when it was. The thing today, though, is we didn't have the internet, which is probably good in those days, but with the internet and everything around it and the media coverage, the coverage is actually 10 times more. You know, everybody wants to know every individual thing about every individual player. So the intrusion is probably a lot more than it was in our day when it was just two TV channels and, you know, the broadsheets in this country. Now it is a worldwide thing and every media outlet wants some part. So for the players, I'm sure it's a massive, probably bigger thing than in our day. That said, you know, for me, it was, you know, for me, the time that it got tarnished a little bit, the FA Cup, was when Man United pulled over to go to the World Club Championships. I don't know if you remember that. They as champions, they were allowed to go, and they didn't put a team in the competition. And, you know, so that was a bit disappointing, and from then the cup has taken some of the credibility out of the cup. But now it's the last game of the season again. It's a massive build-up. Two of the biggest teams in the country. For the players themselves to play, you know, you can play all your life. I played all my career. I've got one winner's medal for fourth division champions. I've got promoted another time. Got promoted twice, without any medals, no playoffs or anything like that. And I won an FA Cup winner's medal. And I played 17 years. And I would say that is probably, you know, that is in the top 10% of what players achieve. Mm. Because a lot of players play their whole life, don't win anything. You know, even the top players. I mean, I think Alan Shearer won, you know, played all his career, best player, one of the best goal scorers ever to play in the Premier League, won the league once. So winning trophies is, as I say to people, you know, I sometimes do chats for players and such like, at the end of the day, your kids won't ask you to see a copy of your wage packet at your peak. You know, they'll want to see something like a medal. Because a medal holds everything about what you were and what you did. Your wage builder, your wage slip doesn't necessarily cover that.
Where is the medal?
It's on display. I used to have it locked away in my safe for years, and I thought, well, that's a bit of a waste of time. So I've got it out. I've got a little box, and I've got it in my front room. So you walk into my front room, you can see it.
Ah, nice.
I've got to say one thing. I mean, I do love the way Americans do things, but the fact that they give the rings, you know, that they can wear to do's, like they can wear to, you know, their whatever major do's they go to, like PFA dinner or whatever. Yeah. I think it's a great, great thing that players could turn up with a cup final ring and have it on their finger. Something garish and something big and something expensive, but shows that they won a cup. I think that's a terrific idea, and perhaps it's probably a better idea than a medal. But I've got my medal on display. Come to my front room, you can see it.
The good amount of those Liverpool players who played in 88 had already won a cup final in 86 or went on to win one in 89. but they were on the receiving end of this shock. What was the atmosphere like at full time, and as he headed back to the dressing room, what was the reaction like from the Liverpool players?
Well, I'll tell you what the reaction was like. By the time we'd done the lap of honour, done our media things, got back in the dressing room, so you're talking 20, 25, 30 minutes probably, tops, back in the dressing room. And all of a sudden thought, well, we haven't swapped shirts. And in those days, you only got one shirt for a cup final. You didn't, you know, today they get one to swap and one to keep, you know. So me and Dave Besant went next door to the away dressing room to knock on the door to see if we could swap shirts for them. And they'd gone.
They were gone from the stadium?
They were gone, yeah.
No hanging about?
No hanging about. Not what they expected. They weren't hanging about. And likewise, 80% of that crowd were Liverpool fans as well. Because you've got to remember, we averaged about 6,000, 6,500 at home. So, you know, our crowd fan base is smaller than Bournemouth, you know. And so if we had 12, 15,000 fans there, I'd be surprised. But, you know, all those Liverpool fans had left the stadium as well. So we'd do a lap of honour, and we're doing it to a three-quarters empty stadium. So that's my abiding memories. You know, we weren't there to be celebrated by the Liverpool fans, that was for sure, all by the team who disappeared.
What was the party like that night?
Oh, brilliant. I mean, I've got to say, in all my time at Wimbledon, and we were ramshackle. We were a non-league club in everything apart from the team on the field that were a Premier League club. The ground was non-league. The administration was non-league. Everything, you know, 5,000, say 6,500 average. Didn't have to have a Premier League outlay. It was non-league in every aspect apart from the team that went on the field. That day was the one, or that night was the one night where they did us proud. I mean, they had a marquee on the pitch, so we came down the tunnel into a marquee. Everybody had an individual table for guests and that. They did Match of the Day live from there, so there was Jimmy Hill and Des Lynam. They were presenting it live from a little bunker in the corner.
Right.
So they got us all into it, you know, at certain times to talk to us live, because then Match of the Day was live in those days, not pre-recorded. And it was just an excellent night. As I say, I always think of it as the one time when would the actual football club did everything right for the players, and it was a fantastic night. That said, by about 12 o'clock at night, I didn't eat, because, you know, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're talking, you're drinking, but you're not eating. 12 o'clock at night, and it was 100 degrees that day, pitch side. So, you know, by then, everything had come in, tiredness, the drink, and I was just falling asleep, and I said, I've got to go back to the Canizares, which is a lovely hotel on the Common. So I was on my way out, back down the tunnel with my wife, and I met my brother coming in, because he'd been out celebrating. He'd bet on me I think he had 10 quid on me at 33-1. Oof. So he actually won more money, because we didn't get a bonus for winning than I did. So he was literally coming into the tunnel as I was walking out, and I said, "Where you been?" He said, "Oh, you know, I've been having a drink, been celebrating." He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going back to bed." He said, "What do you mean you're going to bed? It's 12 o'clock. You've just won the cup final. You're winning the score. You've got to stay up forever." I said, "Vince, I'm falling asleep. I can't keep my eyes open. I'm knackered." I said, "I'll tell you what. You go in, celebrate for me. Get out to the hotel in the morning, and you can come on the... I'll get you on the coach, and you can have the bus ride with us around town." Didn't see him for about 3 weeks. He was the last man chucked out of that marquee, and just missed the bus ride. And I saw him 3 weeks later. He was still celebrating.
The winnings didn't last too long.
I mean, in those days, £330 was a lot of money.
Laurie, it's been brilliant to talk to you. I won't lie, you made my seven-year-old self cry quite a lot. I'm sure you've
told me that as well.
I'm sure you've heard that a lot down the years.
Yeah, no, but they've had their moments since, to be fair. And they got them back. They beat my Wickham team in the semi-final in 2001. So, you know, my life has been tied up on Liverpool.
Yeah, I got to the stage by 2001 where I wasn't shedding too many tears over Liverpool anymore. Laurie, great stuff. Pleasure to talk to you, and enjoy the reunion tomorrow night.
All right, thanks very much.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Graham Hunter, good evening.
Hi, Nathan, how are you?
I'm all right. So Spanish clubs have now won 8 of the last 9 European titles. This league you cover is not so bad.
Yeah, they've only won it because they're extremely good at football. There's no help in the location where finals are played, nor from the referees. I think, honestly, I know, having grown up in an era where Germany won everything, clubs, the national team, I'm well aware that everybody around the world starts to root for other clubs, whether they like Marseille or not, whether they like Liverpool or not. Everybody, with the exception of Gary Neville, is probably rooting for Liverpool next week in Kiev after Atleti adding to the litany of clubs who go from La Liga and either face a La Liga opponent in a European final or else show the other team that they've got better players, better tactics, better nerve, noisier fans. It's a pretty demolishing record that the Spaniards have. And I think the last time that a Spanish team was beaten in a knockout European final other than by another Spanish team was Valencia and Bayern Munich, a game I was at in Milan in 2001, which is a couple of years ago.
Wow, yeah, that's a pretty incredible record. And last night, finals, they don't generally go according to plan. Freakish things tend to happen. But last night was the complete opposite. Atletico showed incredible confidence in their defensive system and Griezmann delivered with the flair and the panache up front. Was it Diego Simeone's game plan? Was that it executed to perfection?
Listen, Nathan, it's overdue that you call me out and disagree with me on something, but my absolute firm sort of conviction, as it was before the match too, I'm not trying to sort of retrospectively claim credit, the better team won. If you look, before you look at how Atleti defend, even if you take into account, say, the first 10-15 minutes where Marseille were all guns blazing, a little bit like Manchester United in Rome against Barcelona, where you can clinically say, well, there was a small period when they looked competitive. Beyond that, Marseille did not have the players, man for man or as a team. French league is weak in terms of team play, in terms of quality, in terms of an ability to cope with a team that has exceptional footballers to pose them questions. And beyond that, you know, Payet, if you're a West Ham fan, whatever you think about him, he's a footballer who can do special things, who can turn games. It stunk the fact that everybody around Marseille said he wasn't going to be ready. He started rather like Diego Costa in Lisbon against Real Madrid. I couldn't have told you for sure he'll go off in the 15th or 20th minute, but it didn't seem at any stage that he was right. And therefore, when you get a situation like that, you know that the coach in charge of the club that plays the player who shouldn't be on the pitch is desperate and knows they're going to lose. The distance between the two teams at the end, the fact the first goal came from a mistake, even before you talk about Koke's brilliant display. And I think that's essential to say that when the defence is praised for Cholo Simeone's Atleti in general and in Lyon, you must mention that Oblak is at or around the best keeper in the world. I think it's a one-on-one, with all due respect to Marc-Andre ter Stegen, it's a one-on-one fight between Oblak and David De Gea for the outright number one keeper in the world. And then in front of that back four that concedes so rarely, Gabi is tiring and is old, but is a street fighter and he's taught Koke well. So when Griezmann scores, just the role Koke plays in the goals and in the domination and the way in which he can break up play, organise the midfield, put intelligence into the passing and make a killer pass, made it really close that Koke might compete with Griezmann for man of the match. And if you pitch all that against what you saw from Marseille, you know, collectively or individually from the coaching, it not only did the right team, and I honestly, in that instance, didn't believe that there was any other result likely.
Marseille did have a very early chance and maybe did at 2-0, did a bit of a flourish for 10 minutes towards the end. But again, Atletico just seemed to have that inbuilt confidence in the way that they're set out to play, that it never looked as though they were going to throw this away. And you mentioned the coaching there. How, like, you look at that and you just know it takes hours and hours of work on structure and the boring stuff. The stuff that, I remember recently talking to DeAndre Yedlin up at Newcastle about Rafa Benitez. He said, listen, it's not fun what we do, but ultimately we're safe, we finish mid-table, so the ends justifies the means. What's Simeone like on the training ground? Is it 11 on the pitch, play for 10 seconds, stop everybody, check your positions, pull somebody back 5 yards. Is it that intense?
It was, Nathan, in 2011, 12, 2012, 13. After that, it's about nuance. It's about fine detail because he has got, and if you notice, I'm really glad that you mentioned that because Rafa Benitez is a different coach from Simeone. Rafa Benitez on the coaching pitch, as you and I both know, is on you like a hawk, will complain about being 2 inches out of position or having your body turned 1 inch the wrong way. He's that meticulous. Simeone's different. Simeone is asking that 4, 5, even 6 players are moving in complete harmony in terms of when they move left, right, forward, back. If one guy breaks out to deal with a situation, then the blanket reaction around him must be perfect. So sometimes they'll train in what looks like, well, we used to play at school across the border, where you used to run across the playground and the caught ones used to hold hands to try and trap whoever was running across the border. Training can be like that. A lot of hand-holding, a lot of coordination to make sure that a small number of players, say 4, can contain a larger number of players, say 7. And it isn't about ingenuity. I've seen that often across Spain. So, for example, a drill that helped Spain win the World Cup in 2010, repeatedly, again and again, in Potchefstroom, was a keeper, Pepe Reina usually, and 2 defenders against 4 attackers running at them from the halfway line. Now, your point from Newcastle is that initially when you're learning that, it's not only a little bit boring, it can be disconcerting. You're told to do things that aren't necessarily natural to you because there's a very particular coaching specification and what you're doing isn't about you and your opponent, it's about you and your teammates at all stages. But now that the majority of that squad has been together since Cholo Simeone took over, particularly the outfield players. So, albeit that it's only human that occasionally in La Liga there might be a drop, and in the Champions League there was a drop in efficacy, particularly in scoring. And that's really the only thing that's ever in doubt with Atleti. Do they get the first goal? And against a really good opponent, do they get 2 goals? So I understand the comparison with Rafa Benitez, but Simeone is not the yeller and the shouter and the bully that he appears on the touchline when he's going absolutely crazy. If you're crossing the line, if you're disobeying him, if you will not listen, fine. You get one hard look, one hard telling off, and then you're out the door. Other than that, he's a guy who believes in raising up morale, about having individual psychology coaching sessions. He takes time out to ask the players about how they are, like how their family are, what they're watching on TV. He gets under their skin in a way which is not Sergeant Major only, despite the ferocious outlook that you get when you see him on the side of pitches. Yes, he's demanding. Yes, he will cut you off if you will not learn his way. But he's a very different teacher. He gets really involved and he gets people's loyalty, which I think is vital in any level of sport.
We're probably guilty of talking about Simeone in a where next, linking him with Chelsea, linking him with Arsenal. It's probably a good time actually to pause and recognise what he's actually achieved at Atletico, going up against arguably the greatest club side of all time in Barcelona and a Real Madrid side that could show a dominance in the Champions League that we've rarely seen in recent decades. To win 2 Europa Leagues, a La Liga title, a Copa del Rey, to get to 2 Champions League finals. The dynasty that he's built up, they're going to build a statue of this guy outside the Wanda. Is that something that plays on his mind, that actually instead of looking at what's next, what he can do if he stays for 10, 12 years rather than the 7 he's been there now?
Nah, that's asking me to anticipate more than I know, because that's a very long period in football. And the reason that I'm ducking away from might he be tempted to do a 10, 12 year stint is that he's not planning that far. I'll tell you 2 things that are factual. One, I think he'd already be committed to being Chelsea manager this summer if he could learn English. Chelsea have been back in contact with him. The first contact came directly to Cholo Simeone's sister, who will represent him, when they knocked Mourinho's Chelsea, I'm sure, out of the Champions League semi-final in 2014 and went on to lose that game in Lisbon to Real Madrid. At that stage, he wasn't ready to go. Their interest hasn't dimmed, and for the very reasons you've explained, well, why would it? Cholo Simeone has been attempting to learn English, not specifically to join Chelsea, but because he knows it's a tool that he's going to need if it's not Serie A next, where Lazio and Inter are forming a queue for him, where his Italian is fine, where the brand of football and the types of players will fit to his methodology. But, you know, the Premier League is, you know, is eons ahead of Italy in terms of importance, in terms of recognition, quality of opposition, pay. That's a big factor. And his assistant, Mona Burgos, speaks good English. And therefore, it's feasible that Chelsea's renewed interest, which is now months old this season, could still end with Cholo Simeone going there, but I don't think it will. I think that he wants to be able to speak the language of the country that he works in next, and he is attracted by continuing the success at Real Madrid. But the other point that I want to make that is true, factually true, and will determine the length of his stay is, he keeps saying, give me consistency in my squad. He's understood that occasionally a big name will be sold. And in that six and a half year period where he's won six trophies and made four European finals, and those who have been lovingly burying their cynicism or their disappointment in Arsene Wenger and saying he's the loveliest, greatest man ever who changed the Premier League, need to take a right good look at themselves and say, no. You know, Wenger's last few years showed he'd been changed by the Premier League, dropped his standards, and Simeone is the yardstick by which that's how, on a smaller budget, a smaller club than Arsenal, with a smaller fan base, fewer facilities, less coaching staff, less scouting staff, you reach four European finals, you earn vast amounts of Champions League money, which is what Wenger's yardstick was. You pick up domestic titles, you finish ahead of Real Madrid this season for only the second time in 22 years, blah, 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 blah. So Simeone wants a consistent squad, even if occasionally a star is sold. And that's what the club have been giving him. That's why he's stayed switched on, plugged in and completely committed and not dropping his levels. And for all of us who work here in Spain, Nathan, long may that last, baby.
Yeah, and it's quite a compliment to him as well that players who do leave, who do go on, make those big moves, the like of Felipe Luis and Diego Costa, end up coming back, and that they want to go and they want to work with him and see what they can achieve again. And even Fernando Torres, who Simeone wasn't in charge of when he left initially, comes back for this last hurrah. Last night was the last time he'll be involved with Atletico. It was a really nice touch to see him lifting the trophy, and it's hard to believe in many ways that he's 34 at this stage. Is this seen as, this second spell at Atletico, is it seen as a success?
Yeah. I mean, undoubtedly, because they've been competitive. He's had a reasonable amount of games. He's had a reasonable number of goals. So therefore, across the board, whether you're an Atleti-oriented analyst or journalist, it's regarded as a success. He's now played a part, rather than last night's two-minute testimonial in Lyon, he's played a part in getting to this final. He deserves his medal. He scored against Real Madrid. They have been competitive. There's been Champions League money. The fans adore him. The day that he came back and they opened the gates, the stadium, the Calderon was practically full. And he still talks about that as being one of the best days of his life. Mm. And he said last night on the pitch that, in sentimental terms, this was his number one night, ahead of winning the World Cup final, ahead of winning the Champions League, ahead of scoring the winner in Euro 2008, blah, blah, blah. This was his number one in terms of sentiment.
Right.
Because he won a trophy for Atleti. And the two things I can throw into what you said is, number one, it wasn't Simeone and he don't necessarily always see eye to eye. It's not daggers drawn, it's not a major problem. But it wasn't Simeone who decided that Torres should come on and actually be on the pitch to win his first ever Atleti medal. That was Griezmann. When the score went to 3-0 and Gabi tucked that one home from the right of the penalty box, Griezmann celebrated, then went over to Mona Burgos and said, get Torres on for me. Now, I like and respect that. And if you're asking about the gauge of success, for a fellow player to say, give this man, who I don't know all that well, Griezmann's not got a massive relationship with El Nino Torres. That was a big, big moment, and it wasn't Simeone's decision. And therefore, success, definitely. Europa League with Chelsea, Europa League with Atleti, World Cup, European Championships.
He lived the dream.
An extraordinary player, and he's not finished yet. He is finished at Atleti. And the goodbye at the weekend, and when they play Eibar, and when they need a point, in order to assure themselves of finish second will be an extraordinary outpouring of emotion a couple of hours before a similar outpouring of emotion at the Camp Nou when Barca host Real Sociedad and Iniesta kisses his 99,000 beloved fans goodbye.
I do want to talk about Barcelona and Iniesta and losing that unbeaten record and what it means in terms of their greatness, and maybe it was appropriate that they didn't get to go through the entire season unbeaten, but we're pretty short on time, but we will look back on the entire La Liga season next Thursday night, Graeme.
Love it. Chat, Nathan.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.